KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Most of the horrific crimes of the Nazis during World War II are well known, but one aspect of their criminal reign has received somewhat less attention, their systematic looting of European artworks. As bizarre as it seems, one aspect of Nazi fanaticism seems to have been its relentless pursuit of art. A new documentary film called The Rape of Europa, based on a book by the same name, tells this story. And in the hour ahead, we'll hear the saga of art theft during World War II and the effort to rescue and return that art to its original owners. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Year after year, an aspect of World War II seems to be documented on film. Last year, Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima told the story of one climactic battle. And this fall, public television will present a major new multi-part documentary series about World War II by noted filmmaker Ken Burns. But just when you think there isn't more to be done on screen, there comes a story that still needs to be told. So it is with a new documentary called The Rape of Europa. The Rape of Europa documents the incredible story of Nazi art thievery before and during World War II. For a dozen years, the Nazis conducted the systematic theft of tens of thousands of artworks they coveted and the destruction of art and buildings they despised. The documentary recounts this tale from Poland to France, Italy to Russia. The Rape of Europa is a story of loss, but it is also one of triumph as we learn about the heroic efforts of men and women who work to rescue lost art and return it to its rightful owners. The Rape of Europa is based on a book of the same name by Lynn Nicholas, and it opens today at various theaters around the Bay Area. Joining us now to talk about the film and the looting of art during World War II, Bonnie Cohen. She's executive producer of The Rape of Europa and produced and directed the film along with Richard Burge and Nicole Noonan. Bonnie, good morning.
Hi, nice to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Lynn Nicholas joins us as well. She's the author of The Rape of Europa, The Fate of Europe's Treasures in the Third Reich and World War II. She joins us this morning from Washington, D.C. Lynn Nicholas, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Bernard Taper is here, too. He is one of the so-called Monuments Men. They were the group that worked to help identify, catalog, and save stolen art at the end of World War II. Mr. Taper is also a former writer for the New Yorker magazine and a professor of journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. Bernard Taper, good morning.
Good morning.
And joining us from New York by telephone, Sharon Flesher. She's the executive director of the International Foundation for Art Research in New York, also known as IFAR. Sharon Flesher, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you all. It's a fascinating story. And Bonnie Cohen, why don't you start us out, and then Lynn Nicholas, I'll ask you to join in as well. On the story as it begins, in a sense, with Adolf Hitler's own frustrated art ambitions, I guess you would say. He was, to some degree, I guess you could call an artist, and applied at one point to admission to the prestigious Academy of Fine Arts in Vienna. How does that begin our story?
Well, we are trying to create the premise that Hitler is an obsessive art collector, and he's obsessed by art on all sorts of different levels. The first of which is that he considered himself an artist himself, and he considered himself a fine artist, and he applied to Vienna along with many of who are now icons of the modernist revolution in art that went on in Vienna at the turn of the century. He was not admitted to the film to the Art Academy, and as Jonathan Petropoulos, one of our other historians in the film, poses, many of the panelists, many of the judges at the Art Academy were Jewish, and he felt judged unfairly. And there is a premise that it is potentially true that this fueled his anti-Semitism and his cultural policy later on in the war.
Lynn Nicholas, add to that in the way in which Hitler and others within the Third Reich were obsessed with With art, we see in the film the way Hitler pursued so relentlessly particular works, as did Goering and others in the Third Reich. Describe that sort of almost fanatical, maniacal pursuit of art that those leaders of the Third Reich had.
Well, I think, you know, Hitler was, an artist manqué, but by the time he got to power, things had changed quite a bit, and by then he'd become, in his own mind, I think, a sort of the new emperor, and he wanted to live in palatial houses and indeed build lots of palaces. He wanted to build a huge museum complex in his hometown and fill it with art so that he could compete with people like Napoleon and all, you know, and Italy and all the most famous museums in the world. So that was one reason. And he concentrated in doing this on Germanic art, anything Germanic, and that got to be a very broad definition. And basically, they found an excuse to make almost anything Germanic if they wanted to, was to be, you know, sorted out and brought back from all over Europe and put in this huge museum that actually never got built. But he had very sort of bourgeois taste in art. He didn't like anything modern. He didn't like anything what he called unfinished. That meant impressionists or expressionists or, people like Kandinsky, people like Miro, anything that wasn't absolutely representational, and particularly that showed the glory of the German people. So that was his obsession. Goering, on the other hand, considered himself a Renaissance man, and he had 8 huge houses, very, very luxurious, and he just wanted to stack them up with all the things that he'd wanted all of his life. So he collected in a very different way. And all the other Nazi leaders sort of fell in line. It was just sort of the in thing in the Nazi leadership to have your own art collection.
And the flip side of their particular pursuit and passion for art that they liked was also joined by the degree to which they despised certain kinds of art. And it seems in a way, Lynn Nicholas, that desire also was tied to their other efforts, whether it was book burning or what we now would consider ethnic cleansing in what became the Holocaust, to sort of rid the world of things they don't like. Do you see that sort of continuity between what they despised in art and what they despised in people?
Absolutely. There's a parallel that they wanted to purify the German people or the people who lived in Germany and rid that country of, and then finally the Third Reich would be rid of what they called alien races, which were the Jews, the Gypsies, and eventually that would include all the Slavs. So that was really quite a lot of people. And the same would be true of art. It had to be pure and Germanic and representational and show, you know, noble German maidens and heroic German soldiers and farmers and things like that. But the old, you know, the older art was, if it, as long as it was German, was okay, and that spread very, or Nordic, so that, you know, Rembrandt was a Nordic artist, Rubens, anybody who was from the north of Europe, but then they would find out that, you know, they would create, as I said before, they would find Nordic blood in all kinds of artists, so that would make it okay for them to keep these things and steal them from other countries.
Lynn Nicholas, the author of The Rape of Europa, the book which has become a new film called The Rape of Europa, which opens at a variety of Bay Area theaters today. In fact, it will be at the Smith Rafael Film Center in San Rafael, also the Embarcadero Center in San Francisco, and the Shattuck Theater in Berkeley, all opening tonight. We're joined by not only Lynn Nicholas, the author of the book upon which the film is based, but also Bonnie Cohen, the executive producer of the film, Bernard Taper, who is one of the monuments men who helped to work to bring those stolen works of art back to their rightful owners, and Sharon Flesher, who directs the International Foundation for Art Research in New York. Bernard Taper, let's bring you into this story. Describe the magnitude of the problem that we've heard Bonnie and Lynn Nicholas outline, this pursuit of art, the thievery, the looting of art from all across Europe and into Russia. What sort of problem, then, were you confronted with when you entered into this picture as one of those assigned to the idea of rescuing that art?
Well, the Monuments and Fine Arts section was comprised of a few hundred people, not enough by long shot for the work that they were trying to do. We had not just one task or one charge or one responsibility. We had double or triple responsibilities that were significant. One of it was during the war, actual war, of trying to make sure that we ourselves didn't do any more damage than we had to.
One of the more amazing scenes in the film, in fact, is the effort that was taken, for example, in the bombing of Italy to try to make sure that bridges weren't destroyed or that certain museums or historic buildings weren't destroyed.
Right, but airplane bombing is not such a precise art. And most of the cities that I saw or visited were heaps of rubble. And in fact, the bombing that we did and the British was called blanket bombing. And the word terrorize actually came into it, except we had accepted the task of being the terrorists. The heads of the Air Force, both British Air Force and American Air Force, had said that their motive was to, in doing this blanket bombing, one of us by day and one by night, was to terrorize the population so that they would force the government to give up. So it was one of the things that I was very much conscious of all the time that I was in the years, a couple of years that I was there, was the heaps of rubble, the destroyed buildings, the awareness that under those rubble were women and children and old people. I was very much there. So that was the one side of the thing. The other side is that our monuments people were often consulted by the Army and the military in general when there was in regard to what they ought to be having the troops look out for and try to save if they could. And so that was one of our tasks. Other tasks was to find as much of the art stuff that had been looted and preserve it in the ways that museums could do.
Give us some sense of the scope of the problem, Bonnie Cohen, the magnitude of what was stolen, and to a degree, I suppose, the surprise that I at least found that as much was rescued as was.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is actually a piece of Lynn's research, but the calculation is that about a fifth of Europe's great art was taken. Or went missing. And at the end of the war, these few hundred people, monuments men and women, set up collecting points in different places around Europe, mostly in Germany. And all of the art that was found, mostly in salt mines, hidden in caves, hidden in strange hiding places in the countryside, all over the German and Austrian Alps, were taken to these collecting points. And as Lynn says very aptly in the film, it was like running a movie backwards. All of the art that had been taken from the finest museums of Europe and the private collections were returned. And I think it's safe to say that the majority of art was returned. Now, you wouldn't know it from all the current restitution cases that you hear about it in the news, but the fact of the matter is that those are the amongst the hundreds or thousands of cases that are left.
And it is striking, Sharon Flesher, that this is an ongoing story. Here we are more than 60 years after the conclusion of World War II, and it's still something that is being fought out to a degree about restitution, about who the rightful owner of a particular artwork can be. Describe for us why that's such a complicated process, because it would seem on the one hand, well, you just give it back to the heirs of the original owner.
Yes. Well, actually, let me step back and just say that it's also not surprising that the issues are coming forward now because there's a confluence of circumstances that has made that happen, such as the fall of the Soviet Union, the opening of World War II archives that were sealed for 50 years, et cetera. So there's access to material that wasn't available for many years from the 1950s and 60s until the 1990s. As well as publications like Lynn's book in 1993 and a few others that followed that raised some of these issues and drew on new research. So just to set that stage, because I think that's important as to why now these things are coming forward, as to the complexity of the restitution, yes, indeed, it's complex because, one, we're dealing with international laws, not just local laws, and the laws change from country to country and even within the United States from state to state, so that many of the battles, if you will, to recover the work are jurisdictional battles. Whose venue, whose location will adjudicate the particular battle? So that's one issue. Another is that a lot of documents were lost during the war and in the passage of time since, so that sometimes it's not clear the actual facts of a given case. And each of these cases is indeed fact-specific and case-specific. So although there are some generalizations one can say about the laws in terms of statutes of limitations and ownership rights, one has to know the specific facts of a given case in order to flesh out the details. And then let me add that in the United States, since we are in the U.S., we're reading mainly about U.S. cases. We're dealing with current possessors of the work, current owners of the work, who in most cases, really almost all cases, acquired the works as what would be called good faith purchasers, meaning they didn't know that there was a tainted history to the given works, that over the years, over the 50, 60 years since the end of the war, the works have passed hands sometimes several times, and the current owner acquired the work for a certain amount of money in full legal, openly, and as far as they were concerned, fully legally.
Yeah. There's sorry to interject, but there's an interesting example of that in the film, Bonnie Cohen, of a work of art that is in the possession of a museum in Utah. And what winds up happening, describe that story about how that work was discovered as and its actual history revealed.
Sure. Well, Nancy Yeide, who is an archivist at the National Gallery in Washington, D.C., and a Hermann Göring expert, she's writing a new book and doing research on a book for that's going to really analyze Göring's collection, his art collection. She came upon this Boucher painting on the website of the Utah Museum, and she recognized it because she had been in contact with the family who had originally had one of the prominent Jewish galleries in Paris, and she had been in touch with them, and she recognized it as one of the paintings from their collection. So this was a case where there was a very clear line between something that Göring's people stole from a very specific family. It went unknowingly. The provenance was, as was said earlier, the provenance was deemed fine and correct and honest, and it ended up in Utah. Now, they did the right thing. They returned the painting to the rightful owners. These were heirs of André Seligman, who ran a prominent gallery in Paris. And what the curator of paintings in Utah was quite upset to lose this painting. It was one of his real prizes in his permanent European collection. But he says in the film, and I think this is so, that you can incur a little humanity by returning something that was stolen, which I think is right. And I think the museums are trying to do the right thing.
And you do see there are emotional moments in the film where you have this sense of return and renewal by these works of art coming back, finding their way home in a sense. Was it that way for you, Bernard Taper? Was it an emotional process as one of the original Monuments Men to find and identify this art and begin the effort, at least, to sort of send it back to its rightful home?
Oh, well, yes, indeed. That was that was something that was made you feel very good to see something good happening on after a war with so many terrible things that happened. Yes, that restoration was, knowing that it was going back, was a good feeling. I should qualify some of the things that have been said here. We had found a lot of things in salt mines, and we put them into collecting points, and that was we tried to take good care of them, of the objects, but we were not restituting to individuals. It was not the job of the United States. We restituted to countries from which they had come. And then it was assumed that a claimant, an heir, would then apply to that country for it. And in many cases, the country made it very difficult for
and
someone.
And it was a long, long process, which, as we've said, continues to this time. And it really relied, Lynn Nicholas, we have to take a break in just a moment, but outline briefly, if you would, the role of some real heroes and heroines in this story, people like Rose Valland in Paris, who cataloged works sort of secretively in a Nazi warehouse, which allowed some of the work to be returned in the end. Because without people like her, this wouldn't have had the number of happy endings that indeed the story does have.
Yeah, so I think we skirted a little bit the sort of Indiana Jones-like aspects of this whole thing. I mean, the curators in Europe while the Nazis were there in the various countries really did risk their lives by trying to hide things and trying to take in Jewish collections to protect them. And Rose Valland was a great example of that. She was as they say in the film, a little gray mouse of a sort of insignificant woman who worked at the Louvre. And nobody knew that she spoke German, and they kept her there. And she, as the Nazis brought in literally tons of work that was confiscated from the Jewish collections, the great Jewish collections of France, she wrote down the code names of each collection. She wrote down the places where they went. She went home at night with negatives of the photographs that they were making of everything, and this was very dangerous. I mean, she could have been executed any time for that, and so she is definitely a major heroine of this whole thing. And then when the Americans came, it was quite interesting because she wasn't sure she trusted them. I mean, a lot of the French wondered if this was just going to be another occupation, so it took a little coaxing for her to give up the information, but she did, and that really, the fact that we had that and knew where to go in Germany really did save even more things, because the Russians were coming from the other way, and there was bombing, and there was, you know, the things were in the way of the line of battle. So
Let me hold you there, if I might. And when we come back, we'll get into some of, as you put it, the Indiana Jones stories, because they're fascinating tales about the work that was done to try to save art during that Nazi time in the 1940s in Europe. Back with more about the story of the Rape of Europa in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, a new film being released today in the Bay Area called The Rape of Europa, which documents the story of Nazi looting of art during World War II and the efforts that have been made to return some of that art to its rightful owners. It's based on a book by the same name by Lynn Nicholas, who joins us this hour, along with Bonnie Cohen, who's the executive producer of the film, Bernard Taper, who was one of the so-called Monuments Men who worked to help identify and catalog stolen art at the end of World War II, and Sharon Flesher, who's the executive director of the International Foundation for Art Research in New York, an organization also known as IFAR. And we welcome your participation in our conversation this hour about stolen art during the Nazi era. You can join us now by calling us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or email us your questions or thoughts at forum@kqed.org. If you have a particular question about what happened in a particular country or a particular work of art, for that matter, call us now at 866-733-6786. Before the break, Lynn Nicholas, you were describing what you referred to that we hadn't really gotten into yet, the sort of Indiana Jones-like quality of some of these stories. So let's pick up on that, because it really is extraordinary what happened in various countries. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what happened in Paris in particular, since we were talking about the role of Rose Valland, and some of what was done to sort of secret the art away from Paris, including the escape of the Mona Lisa by way of ambulance?
Oh, well, the French started to evacuate their works of art from Paris when the war started in 1939, but, you know, the war didn't come to France for almost a year after the attack on Poland, so they had quite a bit of time. And they put their faith in the Maginot Line, their legendary defenses up along the Belgian border, but unfortunately the Germans went right around that. So they had put things in chateaus not too far from Paris along the Loire and stuff, but then when the Germans started pouring into France, it became clear that that wasn't quite good enough, so everything had to be moved again and down further south in France, along with all the other refugees who were going. So it was a totally chaotic scene. And, well, there's one great story that the Mona Lisa, being so precious, was put in an ambulance of her own, and it was sealed up so it would be airtight so the humidity would be right and everything. And there was a curator riding in the back with her, and when they got to where they were going, the Mona Lisa was fine, but the curator was unconscious, so they had to revive him. And I think he was fine later, but that's, you know, really one of the more amusing aspects. But there are just extraordinary scenes in this documentary that Bonnie and everybody, that they found this incredible footage, for instance, of the, I think it's the 82nd Airborne in Berchtesgaden. They'd found Goering's a place where he'd hidden a lot of his things, and here they are in their uniforms carrying sort of statues of Venus and stuff down this hill. I mean, it's just a remarkable thing to see, you know, the army doing that. And I think, you know, Bernard Taper can tell you the story of them finding the Goering train later on. The French, the things were taken from France by the Nazis gradually, you know, probably 20 or 30,000 works of art, and they were sent by train. And right at the end of the war, the French resistance managed to stop one last shipment that was being sent because the Allied forces by then were in close to Paris. And it's really quite amazing that one of the French officers who was with the Allies who liberated this train was Alexander Rosenberg, who was the son of Paul Rosenberg, and a huge number of paintings from his family's collection were in that train. And I don't know if I should mention a competing movie, but it's an old one called The Train with Burt Lancaster, sort of a different kind of movie. And Rose Valland, played by a very glamorous lady in that, and that's really who the heroine is, definitely worth watching. But the adventures were extraordinary, and I think Bernard can answer, you know, testify to this, that for the Monuments Men, it was the most adventuresome time of their lives, and they just had, you know, it was just he was very low-key about his emotions, but really, when they would open the doors of these repositories and see things like the Mona Lisa or Michelangelo's slaves or something, they all write about how extraordinary that was, and that they felt that they were really saving the patrimony of the West, which they were.
Describe that moment for you, Bernard Taper.
I think Lena just described it perfectly. It was very joyous to actually see have actually found things that could have been blown up, could have been burned and destroyed in one way or another, or hidden away. So we were very happy with that. We were also happy that we were doing our best to save German art. This doesn't get mentioned enough. That among our tasks, our responsibilities, was to take just as good care of the German art, the Berlin Museum stuff, Frankfurt Museum stuff, that had been also put in the salt mines or whatever, and curated in exactly the same way that we were curating and preserving the stolen things. That made us feel good. That was beyond patriotism. That was for humanity.
Mm. Bonnie Cohen.
Yeah, it's also important to recognize that in France and in a number of the other European countries, there were the heroines like Rose Vallon, but there were also real heroes and heroines amongst the locals. I mean, these vast museums were packed up by, you know, many of the curators and museum officials and workers had gone off to the front. And so the people who packed up these museums were secretaries and truck drivers and, you know, bricklayers who were hauled in and many came voluntarily and did this work of preservation for their country.
And you managed to find film of that. So we see in the Louvre those volunteers sort of very carefully, people not trained, presumably, in what they were doing, carefully protecting and guiding statues down flights of stairs
the
rest.
That's right.
And to our calls this morning, let's hear first from Craig in Mill Valley. Craig, you're on.
Hi. Gosh, it's fun to be on your show for a change. It's very heartening for me to hear of these pieces of work being returned to their rightful owners, that there's some completion going on. But not all folks who have works of art that have questionable backgrounds are being returned. And there are notorious examples like the Getty Museum, where there are significant numbers of works which have questionable histories that the Getty has resisted. And I don't know the whole story behind the Getty, but it seems noteworthy. What do we do about these groups that seem to have museums or individuals who seem to have works of art that were stolen and should be returned to their rightful owners, and that they're resisting doing that?
Right. Craig, thank you. Thanks for the call. It's a good question. Sharon Fleischer, why don't you take that on? Because we also see in the movie, while we see the nice story of Utah, as Bonnie Cohen describing, doing the right thing, there is resistance in other areas. We see in the movie, for example, about what's going on in St. Petersburg and a resistance among some in Russia, at least, to return works that were taken from Germany, sort of the flip side of the overall Nazi story. But put that in some perspective about, from the museum point of view, the difficulty and dilemma that they face.
Yes. Well, first of all, just to clarify in the question itself, the issues we've been reading about in the press about the Getty really haven't related to World War II era restitution issues so much as what would be called antiquities claims and cultural property claims. And although that's a very interesting subject, I think it's a slightly different one and raises somewhat different issues. To the best of my knowledge, the Getty has not been embroiled in any World War II restitution claim that they've refused to return a work. Regarding the complexity of the other, as I said earlier, many of these cases are fact-specific. So the museums feel that since they hold works in public trust, that they need to be presented with convincing evidence, if you will, that a claim is a just claim, that, for example, that a work that's being claimed was not returned after the war and simply later passed into the normal art market and then eventually ended back in the museum. There, in fact, have been some cases like that, so where a claim was made because the people making the claim didn't have all the facts and didn't know that 40 years earlier the work had been returned. There are, on the other hand, some museums that have been more resistant than others to addressing claims. The museum organizations, the American Association of Museums and the Association of Art Museum Directors, have set forth guidelines as to how museums should proceed when presented with a claim. They're not binding guidelines, but they are guidelines. And as part of that process, the museums have banded together in the United States and set up a portal. It's called the Nazi Internet Portal, where they've listed, they've done considerable research on the works in their collections and listed those where there are gaps in provenance so that people who are searching for works might take a look and see whether any of the works they're searching for are there.
One of the really interesting stories that's told in the film has to do with this question, Bonnie Cohen, and Lynn Nicholas, jump in on this too if you wish, and that's the story of the famous Gustav Klimt portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer and what happens with that. It's the story that begins the film and then ends the film, and it really has to do with who art belongs to.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, which is why we chose it. It's it posits so many important questions about many of these restitution cases, as I think Lynn was saying earlier, I can't remember who said it, laws both in the United States and abroad are not only constantly changing, but they're being written in this area. And the Klimt case is a good example of that. Maria Altman, her paintings, or her aunt's paintings, have been hanging in the National Gallery, or were hanging in the National Gallery in Austria since the war, and she's been trying to get them back for the past 60 years. Now, you know, until her case, an individual U.S. citizen did not have the right to sue a foreign sovereign over a claim like this. So she went all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States to gain the right to actually put that case together and to sue Austria, and she won. So it was precedent-setting in that sense. And then what ended up happening was an arbitration panel of purely Austrian judges decided in her favor. And all five of those paintings came back to her after the 60 years after the war, which is a remarkable landmark case.
I think, but it's necessary to say, often left out of the story, that the family had gotten back several major returns of other things that had been taken from them during the war. And it had sort of come down to these last five things, and the Austrian argument was that, as it's shown in the movie, that her aunt had sort of left a letter of intent way before the war, saying that she wanted the things to stay in Austria. But of course, they sort of happily ignored what had happened during the war. And the returning things right after the war, the governments were very tough about that, because there was a huge art trade and a lot of collaborationist art dealing that went on. So, and they felt very nationalistic, so they were very tough about things leaving various countries. The French have things in that category, the Dutch and so forth. But, you know, now with perspective and a lot more information, that point of view has changed and softened, and the Austrian government did change its thinking and rules on that issue.
And we welcome your calls as well as we continue to talk about the looting of art during World War II and the efforts to restore it. You can participate by calling us now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org, forum@kqed.org. Did you come away from this filmmaking experience, Bonnie Cohen, thinking that we've learned lessons about this? Because you know where I'm going, that in the beginning of the war in Iraq, that there was much made of the looting of certain arts and antiquities from the museum in Baghdad. Is there still more to be learned that we haven't yet really learned about the need to protect art?
I wonder if Rumsfeld has learned anything in the lesson. In his famous press conference about it, he said, "Oh, well, looters will loot, you know." Something of that, to that effect.
And I think it's a fair question. There was a lot to lose, both in Afghanistan and Iraq, particularly antiquities. And Richard Burge, my co-director on the film, has done quite a bit of research on this and learned that, in fact, there were art experts and art historians, much like during World War II, who tried to advise the Bush administration about what the dangers were and what was at stake if looting began in earnest in Iraq. And there was some effort made, but there were not the resources put to it, and there was no follow-through. And I think Bernie and Lynn can also speak to this.
I want to get into this just a little bit. May I?
You may.
there's looting and there's looting. And the big difference, there's always been looting with in wars, of course. But the big difference in this particular case, we're talking about World War II, was that the looting was scrupulously planned and scrupulously executed by the German government, the Nazis. And so it's, it falls into a whole different category and a whole different set of circumstances arise. We've talked about Rose Vaughan's wonderful note-taking and record-keeping, and that was marvelous. But we were certainly assisted by capturing Neuschwanstein and finding there that not all of the detailed records of every piece that had been confiscated by the Germans as part of the records that they learned to keep.
Yeah. So. Sharon Fleischer, were you pulling out your hair when the invasion of Iraq took place? That did you still feel like, boy, we really haven't learned what we need to learn?
Yes, I was. Actually, as it happened, I went to the emergency Interpol conference in France right after that. My organization, IFOR, was the only non-governmental organization that was included in the American delegation. And so I personally and also our organization played an active post-looting role, if you will, on that, and we even devoted a special issue of our journal to that. And if I remember correctly, I was on a KQED program that you did on the looting in the aftermath of that looting. And yes, it wasn't so much that we hadn't learned lessons as Bonnie Cohn just said, there were specialists who spoke to the State Department in just before the war, because there were rumblings that the war might take place. And we did have an idea of what some of the most important archaeological sites were, and also the treasures that were in the Iraq Museum. The real problem, as she said, was not following through, not having the manpower, not anticipating all the events that happened for many, many, many reasons that would take too long, obviously, to go into in this program. And I think we all were pulling out our hair, and frankly, more than that, mourning the loss, because one mourns the loss of art. Yeah. In this case, some works actually destroyed and others still missing these several years later.
Right. Sharon Fleischer, the executive director of the International Foundation for Art Research. We should mention, by the way, that if you're interested in seeing the new film, The Rape of Europa, it starts tonight at various theaters around the Bay Area, including the Smith Rafael Film Center in San Rafael, the Embarcadero Center in San Francisco, and the Shattuck Theater in Berkeley, all playing The Rape of Europa beginning this evening. What's still missing? I know, Bernard Taper, one of your great regrets, in a sense, is that you weren't able to find the painting by Raphael, the portrait of a young man, that's still out there, perhaps somewhere missing. How much is still missing? How much is still to be found?
Oh, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of objects. Some of the greatest importance, things like the Amber Room that was dismantled by the Nazis from St. Petersburg, I guess, and stored away and has never been found. My Raphael, I think of it as my Raphael. It preoccupied me for 2 years. My job, incidentally, was different from the other monuments and fine arts people, and that I was the intelligence officer for the outfit, and that is my main objective was trying to recover lost works that we still hadn't recovered yet, and there were just any numbers of them. There was things that, in addition to the things that the Nazis had taken, there was the stuff the Nazis had confiscated. There was the stuff that got looted by the German populace after the war in a number of cases, particularly the one that is most famous in my memory is what happened to the stuff that was, the art stuff that was on the Goering train when he fled from Karinhal before the advance of the Russians.
Do you think, Bonnie Cohen, we have to take a break in just a second, but that this is a story that will continue to unfold for years and years and years?
Oh, absolutely. I think that we're, first of all, I don't think that we were ready to tell this story until quite recently. And as we were talking about earlier, it hasn't been until the opening up of the Soviet Union and the World War II archives opening up. I mean, we're just starting to understand this. And, you know, who knows what's going on in the black markets, and we still don't know exactly what Russia has. And I think that we're going to see these cases in the news more and more. Absolutely.
Bonnie Cohen, the executive producer of The Rape of Europa. She has joined us along with Nin Lykalis, the author of the book of the same name, Bernard Taper, one of the monuments men who helped to restore art to its rightful owners and countries, and Sharon Flesher, the executive director of the International Foundation for Art Research. Again, if you're interested in seeing the film, it opens tonight at the Smith-Rafael Film Center in San Rafael, the Embarcadero Center in San Francisco, and the Shattuck Theater in Berkeley. As many of you know, this is Pledge Drive time on public radio, and that means that we are going to take a short break for our local listeners on KQED in San Francisco and KQEI in Sacramento. But our conversation will continue online and on the Sirius Satellite Network. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. What do you think still needs to be told? What stories are out there, Lynn Nicholas, that still need to be told that we don't fully yet realize in terms of this ongoing story about the return of art?
I think probably the big, you know, most of the stories will come from Eastern Europe, particularly from the Soviet Union, which does still hold a great number of things. You know, the looting of art was and the recovery was a very emotional thing for them because they lost something like 20 million people during the war, and the Nazis were really out to destroy their entire culture. And so that when they came into Germany, they just took everything they could back with them. And a lot of it's still there, and they're not, you know, politically, it's a big issue there that they're not very willing to give anything back. So what happens with that will be a very interesting thing. And I think there's much more there than we know. You know, that is really the main issue, I believe. In the West, there are so many things that have floated around in the trade, and as various other people have said, that by now they've been through three or four levels of inheritance and sales and things, so they become harder and harder to find and to claim, or the claims get more and more complicated. But I think that I really do feel that the huge amount of the work, the main part is done, but there are a lot of sort of tendrils, if you like, of the looting that are still out there. And I just wanted to add about the Iraq thing, that over the years I've gone a number of times to brief National Reserve units on art looting and protection. So there have been, you know, the Monuments Men tradition was carried on in a very low-key way, and there was certainly a big effort to prepare, but it was, you know, it was not possible to implement it given the way the war was run in Iraq.
Yeah. Let's take another caller. Rafi joins us next from San Leandro. Rafi, you're on.
Yeah, hi. What's the difference between what the Nazis did and what the Europeans did in South America or Africa or Middle East or Far East? What's the difference?
Rafi, thank you. Bernard Taper, you have a response to that?
I didn't hear the question.
The question is, what's the difference between what the Nazis did in Europe and what the Europeans, for example, did, some of the Europeans who colonized Africa?
I think I referred to what I just said before, that the looting that takes place in antiquities mostly is generally done by individuals or perhaps an institution, but doesn't occur as a result of government policy. Whereas in World War II, as I said, there was an absolutely systematic, recorded careful government. They didn't call it looting; they called it confiscation, and that's the difference. One is looting, and one is confiscation.
In fact, Hitler sent art experts into these countries before he invaded them to assess what was there, what he might want to take. That's not the kind of looting that's going on in Iraq. It was systematic. It was planned out and then executed. And not only do you learn how planned out it was, but you also learn that it was really attached to Hitler's cultural policy.
And in that way, what happened with art in Europe is very much of the broader context of World War II. And part of what you get from seeing this film in the end, Bonnie Cohen, is how the looting and the thievery of art was part and parcel of the overall Nazi regime.
That's right.
Yeah, that's the difference.
I'd like to break in and say that the caller is correct, because there was a precedent that the French Revolutionary Armies and Napoleon went on their conquest with very definite art looting policies. They too had lists of things, and they had dealers going with them.
Yeah.
And they had convinced themselves that France was the only cultured place in the world, and that therefore it was okay for them to come back. And when Napoleon went to Egypt, for instance, he took a whole boatloads of experts on flowers, on nature, on
so there's much more. Yeah, there's much more to the story. Yeah, I'm sorry to interject, Lynn Nicholas, and cut you off, but it's implied in that, of course, is there's so much more to the story to be told, but I'm afraid we're out of time, and so we do need to wrap up. We want to thank all of our guests for participating in this conversation, and again, a reminder that the new film, The Rape of Europa, will be seen tonight at the Smith Rafael Center and the Embarcadero Center in San Francisco and the Shattuck Theater in Berkeley. And we should close by also paying some homage to our producer, Hermione G., who's producing her last program today. She has been a great part of our team at Forum, done so much to produce our programs, and we will all miss her very much. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.